Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are immersing ourselves in a piece of cinema that operates on so many audacious levels, the legendary Monty Python's Life of Brian.
It really does. It's a film that manages to be, you know, outrageously silly, but also historically nuanced and, well, a financial miracle in its own right.
Absolutely. We're looking at much more than just a 1979 British surreal black comedy. This is a genuine cultural landmark.
It is. And for this deep dive, we've gathered the sources surrounding its creation, which was incredibly dramatic, almost fatal. And then there's the firestorm of controversy it ignited, both political and religious.
And at its core, this unexpectedly deep philosophical center that I think still resonates today.
It really does. So our mission today is to understand how this film, which is so often named the greatest comedy of all time, navigated these accusations of blasphemy, survived a complete financial collapse just days before shooting,
and somehow solidified its legacy by mocking the very thing it was accused of mocking, which is, you know, dogma and blind faith.
Let's just lay out the core facts for a moment. It was written by and starred all six members of Monty Python. That's Graham Chapman, John Cleese, Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin.
With Terry Jones directing solo this time.
Right. And it was made on a pretty slim budget, around $4 million. But it became this monster hit. It grossed over 20 million worldwide.
And crucially, it was the highest grossing British film in the United States in 1979. That part's key because it really amplified the controversy on a global scale.
Oh, for sure. And the premise, the hook that let them sort of sidestep the immediate charge of blasphemy is just ingenious.
It's all about Brian Cohen, an ordinary young man in Judea,
who just happens to be born in the stable next door to where Jesus is born. And through this escalating series of farcical coincidences and, frankly, bureaucratic errors.
And just human desperation for a leader.
Exactly. He's continuously mistaken for the Messiah.
It's the perfect setup, really, because Jesus himself is treated with respect. He's not the butt of any joke.
Not at all. The comedy is aimed squarely at the followers, at the power structures, at the whole machinery of organized belief.
But before we even get into the plot, we have to start with the production. The story of how this film even got made is, I mean, it's as dramatic as any biblical epic, as our sources show.
It really, really is.
So let's start with where the idea even came from. It really began as just a throwaway joke, didn't it? After the success of Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
It did. They were constantly being asked, what's next? And Eric Idle, probably a bit bored with the question, just flippantly suggested a title, Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory.
Which was itself a joke, a play on the title of the film, Patton.
A deliberate provocation. But when the Pythons actually sat down to write, they established a consensus, a sort of guiding principle that would shape the film and their defense of it for decades.
And what was that?
Well, they all shared this distrust of organized religion, you know, its rigidity, its political power. But they also all agree that Jesus' actual teachings, as they are recorded, were, and I think this is the quote, very decent stuff.
And critically, not particularly funny.
Exactly. Not mockable.
Yeah.
So right away, their target wasn't the prophet himself. It was the interpretation, the bureaucracy that grows around the prophet.
So how did they land on this specific idea of Brian?
Well, they kicked around a few ideas. At first, they thought about maybe a clumsy 13th disciple or something like that.
That would have kept them a little too close to the main narrative, right?
Way too close. Michael Palin notes that the focus shifted to Brian, a completely separate, ordinary man, a secular figure who wants nothing to do with being worshipped. But his life just keeps forcing divinity on him.
And once they had that concept, it seems like the writing went pretty quickly.
Oh, very quickly. The first draft, which was called The Gospel According to St. Brian, was ready by Christmas 1976. And they did the final polish during what Michael Palin called a concentrated two-week writing and water skiing period in Barbados.
That sounds about right. Peak Python. So they have the script, they have the cast, and their original financier was EMI Films, who had done Holy Grail. Everything seems to be set.
It looked like a standard production was about to get underway.
So what on earth went wrong? And why did it happen literally days before they were meant to start shooting?
This is where the story becomes just legendary. The head of EMI, Sir Bernard Delafont, he pulled the plug.
Just like that.
Just like that. The sources say he was scared off at the last minute by the subject matter. But Terry Gilliam gives the crucial detail here. He said EMI had committed the money, but they hadn't actually, you know, sat down and read the script.
You're kidding?
Not at all.
Mm.
Gilliam's quote is, they pulled out on the Thursday. The crew was supposed to be leaving on the Saturday. Disastrous. It was because they read the script. finally.
Wow, that is corporate panic on a biblical scale. Losing your entire funding days before you're supposed to travel overseas, that's usually a death sentence for a film.
It should have been. How they found a replacement that quickly is the miracle here.
And the rescue came from, well, a completely unexpected place. George Harrison.
George Harrison, a huge Python fan. He'd even visited them on the set of Holy Grail. He and his business partner, Dennis O'Brien, they literally formed a new production company, Handmade Films, specifically to fund Life of Brian.
They started a company just to make this one movie.
Instantly. They stepped in with a £3 million, about $4 million US back then, and saved the entire film.
A Beatle founding a film company just because he wanted to see the finished product? That's an incredible level of fandom.
When he was asked about it later, why he took such a huge financial risk, Harrison just said he wanted to see the movie. Terry Jones immortalized it, of course. He joked that the film was the world's most expensive cinema ticket.
And the Pythons, of course, they couldn't resist getting a little dig in at the corporate cowardice that almost sank them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's a great in-joke.
Yeah.
The very last spoken words of the film, it's Michael Palin's character, Mr. Cheeky, and he's teasing Delphont directly. He says something like, I said to him, Bernie, they'll never make their money back on this one.
It's the perfect act of creative defiance. So let's talk about the actual filming. Terry Jones directed this one alone.
Yeah, there was a deliberate move to avoid the kind of feuding that happened when he and Gilliam co-directed Holy Grail. It was apparently quite intense.
So by having Jones direct, Gilliam was free to do what he does best.
Exactly. Focus on the visual aesthetic, the set design, grounding the satire in this gritty, recognizable reality.
And their choice of location was a masterstroke of efficiency, wasn't it? It allowed them to really stretch that emergency budget.
They filmed in Monastir, Tunisia. And the genius of it was they could reuse the huge existing sets from Franco Zeffirelli's 1977 epic, Jesus of Nazareth.
You can just imagine the contrast, this lavish, reverential production, and then the Pythons show up to film their comedy on the exact same streets.
Right. And Terry Jones had this great anecdote about the local extras who'd worked on both films. He said these elderly Tunisian men would come up to him and watch him set up some absurd gag, and they'd just say very earnestly, well, Mr. Zeffirelli wouldn't have done it like that, you know?
That's incredible. Now, Gilliam's visual contribution is obviously essential. What sort of details did he bring to it?
He was all about historical texture, like Pylades Fortress, for example. He designed it to look like a Roman conversion of an ancient synagogue.
Which was a real thing they did.
A common practice. The conquerors repurposed native religious buildings to assert dominance. It immediately grounds the visuals in a reality that makes the satire that much sharper. And of course, he did the animated sequences, including that iconic opening.
And we can't forget the completely random sci-fi scene.
Oh, the spaceship. That was just a brilliant, spontaneous rescue for Brian. Totally inspired by the buzz around Star Wars at the time. Gilliam just did it with practical effects, in camera, with a miniature model and some pyrotechnics. Pure Python absurdity.
On a more serious note, we should talk about Graham Chapman's commitment. He played Brian, the lead, and he was struggling quite severely with alcoholism around this time.
He was. But our sources say he was absolutely determined to do the role, which John Cleese had actually wanted. Chapman sobered up completely for the entire shoot. And on top of that, because he was a qualified medical doctor,
right,
he acted as the unofficial on-set doctor, treating the cast and crew for minor things. A real commitment to a very silly project.
And of course, they had to give their financier, George Harrison, a cameo. Where does he pop up?
It's a real blink and you'll miss it moment. He's Mr. Papadopoulos, the owner of the Mount. You see him in the crowd during the sermon scene.
And he has one line.
One word. A very cheerful scouse, ooh, which was apparently so out of place in ancient Judea that Michael Palin had to dub over it later so it wouldn't be too distracting.
It's just amazing how many things, financial disaster, sobriety, a beetle, had to align perfectly just for this satire to get made.
It really set the stage for a film that feels both meticulously written and gloriously, wonderfully chaotic.
So let's dive into how they translated all that energy into the actual narrative. The whole film's satirical engine is this theme of mistaken identity, isn't it?
It is, and it's built on the most human of flaws.
Yeah.
Bureaucracy and our desperate need for meaning.
It's established right from the very first scene.
Immediately. Brian is born next door to Jesus, which leads the three wise men to, well, get the stable dust wrong. They show up, leave their gifts, gold, frankincense, myrrh, and then have to sheepishly come back and retrieve them.
The most sacred moment in history, undone by a simple clerical error.
Exactly. It immediately introduces pettiness and bureaucracy into the divine.
So as Ryan grows up, he has this political resentment for the Roman occupiers, but his reasons for joining the rebellion are complicated.
They are. His mother, Mandy Cohen, reveals he's half Roman. He is a physical embodiment of the people he claims to hate. That, plus his desire to impress the rebel Judith Iscariot, is what pushes him into the People's Front of Judea, the PFJ.
And the pythons use his first real act of rebellion to skewer Roman pedantry. I mean, the graffiti scene is iconic.
It's brilliant. Brian tries to paint Romani Eat Domum on a wall, which he thinks means Romans go home. But he's caught by a Roman officer.
Played by John Cleese.
Who is absolutely furious, not about the vandalism, but about the appalling Latin grammar.
He makes him correct it, right. Write it out 100 times, like a school punishment.
Yes, because the grammar is all wrong. The officer explains that Romani is the nominative, he needs the vocative, the real mistake is the verb. Domum needs the accusative for motion towards a place. The correct slogan is Romanes und Domum.
So the Roman Empire is more concerned with linguistic purity than with stamping out dissent. That's the perfect bureaucratic mindset.
And that mockery of Roman authority really peaks with Pontius Pilate, played by Michael Palin.
The lisp.
The lisp is key. And his sort of effete nature, it completely undermines his position of power. But the real genius is the names he uses when he tries to talk to the crowd.
Bigasticus.
And his wife, Incontinentia Buttocks. The names are so absurd that the guards, these otherwise brutal, emotionless soldiers, just dissolved uncontrollable laughter. It reduces the ultimate symbol of Roman power to a total laughing stock.
It shows that even these huge power structures are just run by fragile, silly human beings. But the real target of the film is the followers, the birth of a religion. And that starts with the Sermon on the Mount.
And this is so clever. Jesus himself is played completely straight. He has a real aura of authority. But the pythons immediately undercut the reverence with a simple, practical problem. Bad acoustics.
The people in the back can't hear properly.
So they mishear, blessed are the peacemakers, as blessed are the cheesemakers.
And the comedy immediately shifts to misinterpretation. They start debating what cheesemaker could mean. Is it literal? Is it a metaphor?
It's a perfect critique of how dogma is born. People trying to codify and interpret something they barely even heard correctly in the first place.
So Brian, after his detour in the spaceship, he needs to blend in and he accidentally becomes a prophet.
He's just trying to hide among the other street prophets. He repeats a few fragments of Jesus' sermons he remembers, things about the lilies on the field. But when he stops talking, the small crowd that's gathered demands more. They chase him up a mountain, convinced he's the Messiah.
He's become a celebrity against his will, which leads to that famous scene outside his mother Mandy's house.
Where she's trying to get this huge crowd to disperse. And it gives us the line that was voted the funniest in film history. Mandy, played by Terry Jones in drag, just yells, "He's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy."
It perfectly sums up the film's theme. The huge gap between the mundane reality of this guy and the spiritual significance everyone projects onto him.
And the ultimate satirical moment comes when Brian, finally cornered by his followers, tries to use logic to shut the whole thing down.
It's one of the most quotable and philosophically sharp moments in the whole movie.
He tells this massive crowd, "You don't need to follow anybody. You've got to think for yourselves. You're all individuals."
And the entire crowd shouts back in perfect synchronized unison, "Yes, we're all individuals."
With just one lone voice piping up, "I'm not."
That's the absolute pinnacle of their critique, isn't it? It shows how any doctrine, even the instruction to think for yourself, can be instantly turned into an unquestioned collective dogma.
The need for a group identity is just too strong. It devours individuality.
So Brian is captured, and we move to the final farce of the crucifixion.
It's just a cascade of accidents. Pilate offers the traditional Passover pardon, but the crowd, knowing about his lisp, starts shouting out names with the letter R in them just to mock him. "Woodger, release Woodwick."
So when Judith calls for the release of Brian, the crowd just parrots it, thinking it's another joke.
They assume it's part of the game. So Brian's chosen by mistake, sentenced to the most brutal torture imaginable, all because of bureaucratic incompetence and a running gag.
And even on the cross, the comedy continues.
It parodies the famous "I am Spartacus" scene. When the guards come to free Brian, a bunch of other guys on crosses start claiming to be Brian so they can be freed instead. The wrong man gets released. It's his final, ultimate abandonment.
He's abandoned by everyone, The PFJ praises his martyrdom. The Judean People's Front commits mass suicide. Even his mother leaves him. He just sinks into total despair.
And that's what leads to that final nihilistic but somehow uplifting moment. Mr. Cheeky, played by Eric Idle, starts singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
A cheerful show tune set against the backdrop of brutal state-sanctioned torture. I can see why that caused the most backlash.
It did. But it's also what makes the film so powerful.
It's amazing that a film so tightly structured still had so much left on the cutting room floor. Let's get into what they had to cut.
The original rough cut was about 2 hours long. And over time, they cut about 13 minutes. Some of it was for pacing, but a lot of it was.
Well, it was a form of internal censorship, especially around one character, Otto. Otto, played by Eric Idle. He was the leader of the extremist Judean People's Front, the JPF.
Right. And he was designed to be deeply, deeply provocative. He represented this kind of militaristic, quasi-fascistic nationalism. Idle played him with a thin Hitler mustache and a German accent.
And Terry Gilliam took that Nazi visual connection even further with the JPF's logo.
He did. The emblem was a Star of David, but with extra lines added to make it look like a swastika, a really terrifying fusion of symbols. The implication was that any extremist nationalism can take on the characteristics of fascism.
And Otto's dialogue was pretty extreme, too.
He was shown shouting about racial impurity, especially in Brian, because his Roman heritage made him impure in the JPF's eyes.
That feels like a much darker, heavier satire than the bickering of the PFJ. So why was he mostly cut from the film?
The official reason, the one you'll find in Michael Palin's journals, is that Otto's scenes, especially his long rants, just slowed down the narrative. They killed the comedic flow.
But there's another theory, a more commercial one.
Yes. Historian David Nash argues it was a clear case of self-censorship. They were trying to make the film easier to distribute, especially in the huge American market.
Alienating Christians was one thing, but explicitly linking Jewish nationalism to Nazism was seen as just too risky.
Exactly. And there was a big internal debate about it. Terry Gilliam, always the provocateur, was strongly against cutting it. He apparently quipped that since they'd already alienated the Christians, they should go ahead and get the Jews now, too.
He didn't want to compromise the satire. But how did Eric Idle, who created and played the character, feel?
He was reportedly uncomfortable with it. He later said the character was a pretty savage attack on rabid Zionism, suggesting it's rather akin to Nazism, which is a bit strong to take.
So what's the only bit of Otto that's left in the final cut?
Just one brief scene. It's during the crucifixion. Otto arrives with his crack suicide squad. And as a political protest, they all commit mass suicide, stabbing themselves to death.
Which achieves absolutely nothing for Brian.
Nothing. It just confuses the Roman soldiers. And Terry Jones said they only left that tiny bit in because they needed the dead bodies for continuity in the next shot. Otherwise, he would have been gone entirely.
There was another interesting cut involving profanity.
Yes. John Cleese's character, Reg, originally shouted, "You cunt," at Brian after he was captured. But they felt it was too jarring.
It would stop the laughter.
Precisely. Cleese approved changing it, overdubbing it to the much milder, "You klutz." He said he felt the strong reaction to the profanity would get in the way of the comedy. It shows how focused they were on comedic timing.
It's fascinating. The published script has all these deleted scenes, so you can see the roadmap of what could have been a much darker, much less commercially palatable film.
It really was a constant negotiation between their artistic freedom and the practical realities of getting the film shown.
But no amount of self-editing could prevent the firestorm that was coming.
Not at all. As soon as it was released, Life of Brian became a lightning rod for accusations of blasphemy, which led to actual bans all over the world.
It was banned outright in Ireland for 8 years.
And in Norway for 1 year, which, of course, the Pythons used as a marketing tool in Sweden. The poster said, "So funny, it was banned in Norway."
But the censorship inside the UK was almost more insidious, wasn't it? It was done by local councils.
It was. The official British board gave it an AA rating for ages 14 and over. But pressure from groups like the Nationwide Festival of Light led local councils to step in. 11 of them banned it outright. And another 28 raised the rating to X for over 18s only.
And the most shocking part is that many of these council members hadn't even seen the film.
No, they were basing their decisions purely on reports and pressure from religious groups. It was what one historian called textbook internal censorship. The law didn't ban it, but fear of causing offense did.
The protests were widespread, Mary Whitehouse, of course, but it wasn't just Christians.
No, Michael Palin remembered seeing nuns with banners. But in the U.S., screenings were picketed by both traditionalist Christians and rabbis. It managed to offend a very wide spectrum of people, which, ironically, was just great publicity.
And the main focus of the anger was that final scene. The crucifixion set to always look on the bright side of life. The critics called it a jolly boy's outing.
They did. But the Pythons were fierce in their defense of it. They argued correctly that crucifixion was just the standard, brutal Roman method of execution. It happened to thousands of people. It wasn't unique to one divine figure.
Terry Jones had a particularly sharp response to that criticism.
He did. He said, "Any religion that makes a form of torture into an icon that they worship seems to me a pretty sick sort of religion, quite honestly." And that really framed their whole defense.
Mm.
They were satirizing the worship of suffering, not the suffering itself.
This all culminated in one of the most infamous debates in British TV history.
The BBC showdown. John Cleese and Michael Palin went up against the journalist Malcolm Muggeridge and Bishop Mervyn Stockwood on a show called Friday Night, Saturday Morning.
And the two establishment figures made a huge mistake.
A profound one. They arrived 15 minutes late to the pre-screening of the film.
Which means they missed the entire opening sequence that shows, very clearly, that Brian and Jesus are two different people.
Exactly. So their whole argument was based on a fundamental misunderstanding. They thought the film was a direct parody of Christ. The Pythons came prepared with detailed, well-researched arguments, and their opponents hadn't done their homework.
Cleese was apparently astonished by it all.
He was. He said Muggeridge's reputation plummeted in his eyes because the debate was just so stupid. He felt that he and Palin, the young comedians, were forced to be the serious, well-researched scholars while the establishment figures were just making cheap jibes.
This pressure really forced the Pythons to articulate that crucial distinction between heresy and blasphemy. How did they define it for their film?
Their consensus was that the film is heretical, not blasphemous. Blasphemy, they argued, is directly mocking God or Jesus' teachings. Heresy is mocking the practices, the dogma, the bureaucracy, and the people who follow the teachings.
Terry Jones had a great way of framing it.
He said the film is not blasphemous because it doesn't touch on belief at all. It is heretical because it touches on dogma and the interpretation of belief. He used the example of the followers fighting over Brian's lost sandal.
Right, the gourd.
Yes, and calling it the history of the church in 3 minutes. They were satirizing how wonderful teachings are used to persecute others because people can't agree on how he said it.
And years later, academics and theologians basically validated their position.
They did. The theologian Richard Burridge even called it an extraordinary tribute to the life and work and teaching of Jesus because the Pythons, having done their research, realized they couldn't make Jesus' actual teachings funny, so the comedy had to be about fundamentalism and blind faith instead.
And despite all the outrage, the film was a critical success.
It was. Roger Ebert praised their good cheer and irreverence, and its legacy is just immense. Named the greatest comedy film ever in a Channel 4 poll, ranked as one of the best British films ever by the BFI.
And the lines, "He's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy, and what have the Romans ever done for us? They're part of our global culture now."
Absolutely.
So we've established the target isn't religion itself, but the human need to follow. But the sources show the Pythons were using first century Judea to satirize something much closer to home.
Oh, absolutely. The film's true political target was 1970s British left-wing politics. It's a savage satire on what's called the narcissism of small differences.
You mean groups that are ideologically almost identical but spend all their time fighting each other?
Precisely. We're talking about the People's Front of Judea,
yeah.
The Judean People's Front, the Judean Popular People's Front.
The Splitters.
Splitters. These groups are direct parodies of the various Trotskyist and liberation movements of the time, all with their obscure acronyms and intense internal rivalries. Michael Palin confirmed they were modeled on these modern resistance groups. They're so obsessed with doctrinal purity, they're completely ineffective.
And the film shows that absurdity perfectly.
It does. When the PFJ tries to kidnap Pilate's wife, they run into the campaign for a free Galilee, and they immediately start brawling over which group thought of the plan first. They only stop to unify in their shared hatred for the JPF before they start fighting each other again.
It prevents any actual revolutionary action. Which brings us to the "what have the Romans ever done for us" scene.
It's the pinnacle of that political satire. Red, the leader of the PFJ, asks this rhetorical question, expecting his comrades to list Roman atrocities. But instead,
they start rationally listing all the positive things the Roman occupation brought.
And it's an incredibly detailed list. Sanitation, medicine, education, irrigation, roads, fresh water, public order. and ultimately peace. The joke is devastating. The revolutionaries are so focused on their ideology, they can't even acknowledge the material reality of their situation.
They're benefiting from the very system they claim to be fighting.
Yes, they waste all their time debating whether they should be debating so much. They're so caught up in their own dogma that they become completely passive.
Beyond the politics, there's a deep critique of human psychology, this propensity to believe in the extraordinary.
That's the core of it. The way the followers rationalize everything. When Brian tells them repeatedly that he is not the Messiah, that he's nothing special, what do?
They decide that only the true Messiah would be humble enough to deny his divinity.
Exactly. Their systemic need for a leader is so great that they actively twist his genuine human denial into proof of his supernatural status.
So this isn't just a historical joke. The pythons were tapping into some pretty deep philosophical concepts.
Scholars consistently place the film within the tradition of existentialism. Thinkers like Nietzsche or Sartre.
Right.
That scene where Brian tells the crowd, "You're all individuals," is one of its most explicit philosophical statements.
How does it lay out the existentialist worldview?
It suggests the world is inherently absurd, that it has no preordained meaning. And so every life has to be self-defined. You have to create your own meaning. Brian is trying to live that authentic life, but the society around him, desperate for meaning, just relentlessly forces a divine, predefined role onto him.
They can't tolerate his freedom.
I can't. Which brings us back to always look on the bright side of life. If the world is absurd and Brian is totally abandoned, what does that song actually mean?
It's not just simple optimism.
Not at all. It's the film's nihilistic core, wrapped in a cheerful melody. The lyrics are explicit. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. It's saying that since life is meaningless and death is the end, the only defiant appropriate response is humor and resilience. It's an act of cheerful, conscious nihilism.
What's so incredible, given the blasphemy accusations, is how historically accurate the film turns out to be.
Yes, recent academic conferences, even at King's College London, have confirmed the pythons drew on serious, critical, biblical scholarship. They wanted their satire to be grounded.
Can you give us an example of one of those subtle historical references?
Sure. The fact that Brian is half Roman, that he's the son of a Roman centurion. That might be a reference to an ancient polemic legend that Jesus himself was the son of a Roman soldier named Panthera. They wove real historical controversy right into their premise.
What about the ex-leper?
Another great example. The ex-leper, played by John Cleese, complains bitterly that Jesus cured him, because being cured cost him his begging trade. Leprosy was a guaranteed source of income. It's a joke that grounds a gospel miracle in the harsh economic reality of the time. A miracle could actually ruin your life.
So the great irony is that the protesters who said the pythons knew nothing about the Bible were arguing against a film that was, in fact, meticulously researched.
Precisely. They did their homework to make sure the satire was aimed at dogma and human folly, not lazy mockery.
So this deep dive really reveals that Life of Brian is a true cinematic miracle in every sense. It survived a financial collapse thanks to George Harrison.
A move Terry Jones rightly called the world's most expensive cinema ticket.
And it faced down global censorship, often from officials who didn't even understand what the film was about.
All while disguising this profound social critique as surreal, rapid-fire comedy.
And underneath all the laughs, there's this sophisticated engine aimed at political factionalism, that narcissism of small differences, and our frustrating inability to handle real freedom of thought.
The film's cultural footprint is just immense. Always Look on the Bright Side of Life became this genuine cultural artifact. Famously, it was sung by British sailors on the damaged HMS Sheffield during the Falklands War while they were waiting to be rescued.
That's incredible. It shows its true power as this ode to resilience in the face of catastrophe.
And its political legacy is cemented too. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair referenced the PFJ and the JPF during Prime Minister's Questions, parodying the "What have the Romans ever done for us?" line. It's just a standard political reference point now.
And the story isn't over. John Cleese confirmed in 2024 he's developing a stage version.
It seems the central message of Life of Brian, that we are so desperate for a leader that we will turn the instruction to think for yourselves into just another unquestioned collective dogma, remains eternally relevant.
So this raises a final question for all of us then. Given this overwhelming human tendency toward a flock mentality, how can we ever truly distinguish between a valuable teaching that encourages self-definition and the collective, ironic dogma of those who just blindly repeat it in unison?
something to mull over the next time you hear someone shouting, "We're all individuals," in perfect synchronization. A complex and profound legacy for a film about a very, very naughty boy.
Thank you for joining us for the Scape Dive.
We'll catch you next time.